This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Over the years, generations of scientists have worked to catalog all the minerals on Earth. Some of the latest counts top out at about 5,800 different kinds. But a new method of cataloging them has found over 10,000, nearly twice as many. This gives us a better picture of the part minerals have played in Earth's 4.5 billion year history, and it might even give some insight into the geological and maybe even biological history of other planets. Robert Hazen is one of the scientists who worked on the new Earth Mineral Catalog. He's senior staff scientist at the Carnegie Institution's Earth and Planets Laboratory and professor of Earth Sciences at George Mason University. He's also on the Curiosity Mars rover team. Bob, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, we didn't suddenly discover 4,000 minerals we hadn't seen on the planet before. Can you talk about what you're doing differently than the old way of counting these guys?
Yeah, Rob, the old way was to just look at the chemistry and the crystal structure. Diamond is pure carbon in the diamond structure. That's one kind of mineral. But we said, whoa, wait a minute. Diamond forms in lots of different ways. It forms around stars. It forms deep in Earth's mantle. It forms when an asteroid or a meteorite hits a dinosaur and smushes it. And those are different kinds of diamond. One's a stellar diamond. One's a mantle diamond. One's an impact diamond. And so we said, let's think about the different kinds of each mineral. And that got us to over 10,000 different kinds.
Now, if I was to look at a bunch of diamonds, I couldn't tell if that diamond was made from an asteroid, that one was made in a sun, and so on. But you can, or there are ways to do that, right?
Experts can, because they look at all the other things other than just the composition and the structure. So there's the size and the shape, there's the color, there's the impurities, what are called inclusions, which could be solids or liquids. And inclusions in mantle diamonds are very different from inclusions in impact diamonds.
Now, if all I'm doing is making a diamond ring, this distinction probably isn't that important. But if I'm trying to understand, you know, how our Earth got to be the way that it is, it's a pretty important distinction. What kind of things do we learn when we look at it in this different way?
Well, Rob, it's a huge distinction because time becomes an important part of our classification. The stellar diamonds formed more than 5 billion years ago. The mantle diamonds maybe 500 million years ago. An impact diamond might have formed 50,000 years ago. And they're different temperatures and pressures and conditions. I think they're different kinds of diamond. And that's really important if we want to understand how planets form, how they evolve, and how life formed and evolved as well.
Yeah, what can we learn about how life formed and evolved, past tense, on the Earth, and maybe could evolve on other planets in the future?
So one of the amazing things that we discovered was that about half of all the different kinds of minerals on Earth are formed directly or indirectly by life, by biology. That's a shocking thing. In fact, a third of all those mineral species, that's about 2,000 different kinds of minerals, form only through biological processes. So life is a huge factor in our planet's mineralogical diversity. And that means minerals could also be biosignatures if we found certain combinations of minerals on other worlds.
Yeah, let's take that to, say, the Curiosity rover over on Mars now. What kind of clues that you're doing with here on Earth, what kind of clues could it be looking for to say, hey, yeah, these minerals probably could have only been formed if there had been life here at some point?
Yeah, so Rob, it's not just the kind of mineral. It isn't just saying, oh, we found pyrite, which is known as fool's gold. It's an iron sulfide, a very beautiful mineral. It turns out in our study, we found there are 21 different ways to form pyrite. So if we found pyrite on Mars, and I hope we do someday, the next question you have to ask is, well, what kind of pyrite? Is it biogenic pyrite? Is it high temperature hydrothermal pyrite? Is it pyrite formed in one of the other 21 different ways? And that's a really important question to ask. Knowing that it's pyrite is just not enough if you want to understand the evolution of planets.
Given that, for now at least, we can't pick up the samples that a rover on Mars finds and bring them back to Earth, I mean, can we do enough analysis on site there via a rover to figure out, say, which of the many kinds of pyrite something might be?
Well, our Curiosity team is certainly able to tell you some of the different kinds of minerals that are there. And because of the geological environment, we're often able to say exactly how they form, and even in some cases, when they form. But it's going to be so much better when Perseverance brings, you know, packs up those samples that it's looking at right now on Mars and flies them back to Earth. And then we can look at those samples directly. And I think one of the key things will be not just to identify what mineral species are there, but what mineral kinds are there. That's going to be a real game changer.
Talking to Bob Hazen, a scientist who worked on the new Earth Mineral Catalog, looking at the origins of a lot of the minerals that we find on Earth today, how they came to be that way, what we learn about other planets with it. Bob, in high school, I had a geology class and I had a biology class, and it still kind of blows my mind that there's way more overlap between those than I think about. Can you talk about some of the ways us life forms shaped, you know, the mineral outline of our planet?
Well, yeah, and it's huge. One of the, of course, major ways is photosynthesis, producing oxygen, because oxygen changed the chemistry of Earth's surface. And basically, the whole surface of Earth rusted. That was a big one. But also, plants, they have roots that create new clay minerals in the soils. The soils get deeper and deeper. Before there were any plants, the soil on Earth's surface was very, very thin. But now in places, it's you know, 20, 30, 40 feet deep as trees get taller and taller. That's a feedback that's just astonishing. It's so many different ways that we find minerals in our own bodies, our teeth and our bones. Those are minerals, but they're minerals of a different kind than the same mineral that occurs, say, in a meteorite.
Now, I often hear, you know, you need water to make life likely on a planet. Are there particular minerals that we'd think of as precursors? You got to have these or these combinations to have a shot at the formation of life.
Well, people are certainly thinking about all different kinds of minerals, sulfide minerals and clay minerals and carbonate minerals. They're hypotheses. No one's come up with the perfect recipe yet. And boy, would I love to be part of that. But another amazing thing is that water, you say, is a part of life. It's also the dominant thing that causes varieties of minerals. About 80% of all the minerals on Earth are formed in one way or another by interaction with water.
All right, just a few moments left. Is there one particular mineral that, you know, if we found it on Mars, you would be, I don't know, spiking a football or whatever was near at hand? You'd be really excited to find there.
Oh, man. I'll tell you one that would be funny to find, and that's the mineral that was named after me. It's called hazenite. It's only found in one place on Earth, and that's in Mono Lake, California. And it's, believe it or not, it's microbial poop. The only way that hazenite forms is when microbes have so much phosphorus, they say, oh, I got to get rid of this. And so they poop out these little crystals of hazenite. If you found hazenite on Mars, I think that would be a smoking gun for for life on Mars.
Hazenite.
I'm not going to put a bet on that, but it's possible.
Hazenite is now the official mineral of Central Time. Bob, thanks for joining us.
It was my pleasure, Rob. Thank you so much.
That's Bob Hazenite with the Carnegie Institution's Earth and Planets Laboratory, part of this huge cataloging project on minerals and what it could mean for the study of other planets. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about a friendly debate between two classic Wisconsin desserts.
We recently received an audience question through WPR's Wisconsin Project about two iconic Wisconsin pastries, the cream puff and the kringle. WPR's Tim Peterson was up to the task of getting to the bottom, or at least the delicious sugary middle, of what separates them.
Marissa Wojcik of Madison grew up in the Eau Claire area, regularly consuming kringle at family gatherings. Her experience with cream puff, on the other hand, is limited. Just one puff. And it did not blow her away, which prompted her to ask us,
why do cream puffs get all the attention when the kringle is the official state pastry of Wisconsin?
Well, certainly cream puffs have been a signature dessert of the Wisconsin State Fair since 1924.
Paula Hare is Director of Marketing and Media Relations for Original Cream Puffs. That's the pop-up bakery from the Wisconsin Bakers Association responsible for making and serving cream puffs for that annual 11-day run.
It is certainly the most popular and longest-running food item at the State Fair. I mean, picture in your mind, you know, all of the sights and sounds of the fair and the giant Ferris wheel lights, and having your first cream puff is certainly an experience just like going to the fair. Our cream puffs are made from Wisconsin dairy-rich cream and also a very wonderful puff pastry, and biting into them is just like a little piece of heaven.
But some people push back on our very serious kringle versus cream puff premise.
Well, cream puffs are delightful. This is the most friendly debate ever.
Shauna Seaver, author of the cookbook Midwest Made, Big Bold Baking from the Heartland. She also had thoughts on the cream puff.
is that nostalgic feel of the state fair, and it's something special that you're not going to have all the time. I mean, and it's something that's like towering and beautiful and delightful and a little over the top, and I think definitely has a place.
Now, for the official state pastry, so anointed by the legislature in 2013, here's Seaver again.
Well, Kringle came to Wisconsin in the late 1800s when there was a huge boom of immigrants from all over Europe in particular, and Wisconsin took a lot of them in, and it became the sort of landing place for a lot of very baking-centric countries, lucky for Wisconsin. And the Kringle was an invention from Denmark, originally actually started out in a sort of pretzel shape, and you still find them in Denmark baked in that way. And then, like so many other baked goods, sort of evolve as they land in their new home. And like any innovative group of immigrants, they sort of tweaked the Kringle a little bit for local tastes, and it's been around ever since.
We wanted to dig a little deeper, get under the crust of what separates these two. Seaver gives us a quick lesson, starting with the cream puff.
In terms of the technique, choux pastry comes together rather quickly, and you can bake it, you know, straight out of the mixer. And then you can dollop your puffs, and then they're baked off. And then when you're talking about Kringle, it's actually based on a Danish pastry, which is kind of similar to a French puff pastry, but there's the addition of yeast, which gives it a little more rise and, of course, that delicious flavor. But it's a laminated dough, which essentially means that you're going to incorporate the butter by rolling and folding the dough several times. So it can be a couple day process to make yourself a good Kringle, which I think is something that a lot of us take for granted because it's something easy to sort of grab and have, you know, for coffee breaks. But they really are very well-crafted, time-consuming pastry.
And like the cream puff, Kringle has a special yet different place in our hearts.
WPR's Tim Peterson brought us that story about two beloved Wisconsin pastries. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, we'll talk to the founder of a Wisconsin group working to make outdoor recreation more diverse and getting people from all backgrounds out in the state's natural spaces. That's next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Tomorrow is primary election day here in Wisconsin. The polls are open from 7 in the morning until 8 at night. Find out what's on the ballot and where you can vote by visiting myvote.wi.gov. Now, a Wisconsin-based group is focused on making outdoor recreation more diverse, providing opportunities for sometimes marginalized groups to enjoy the natural spaces around us. The organization called Color in the Outdoors advocates for diversity, accessibility, and inclusivity and works toward equitable access in outdoor spaces. That includes a wide range of activities, including hiking, fishing, foraging, and spelunking, among many more. Christopher Kilgore is the founder of Color in the Outdoors and a UW alum. We talked with him earlier this year. Here's a listen to that conversation. What did you see out there that made you want to start a group to work on these things?
Well, I guess the easier way to answer that would be what I didn't see. Ever since I was a young child, I spent the majority of my time year-round outdoors when at all possible. And grew up in Madison, grew up right in the center of town. And more times than not, the people that I was spending time with and the people I was surrounded by didn't necessarily look like me. And it wasn't necessarily noticeable as a younger child, but as I got older, it definitely was. And so as I was able to be in a position where I could start acting as a mentor or a role model of sorts with some of the younger folks, but also just as a peer with folks my age and some older, I decided it was in my best interest not only to just be able to have folks to spend time with outdoors, but also to continue that legacy of handing that information and that passion for the outside world down. And as people kind of continue to give me nudges with their elbows saying, you really need to do something more organized. That's how Color in the Outdoors was essentially born.
What are some of the biggest obstacles for people of color to get out and enjoy nature?
Well, I think that there are, you know, the list is long. Unfortunately, I think accessibility is one thing. I think that oftentimes the spaces that we tend to recreate in outdoors are often far away or often kind of sequestered in an area that isn't necessarily accessible. So things like bus lines, things like transportation can provide a barrier. I think another thing is, again, to that point of seeing faces that look like you or seeing people that look like you out on trail. When you're in certain parts of the state, certain parts of the country, certain parts of the city, even oftentimes you don't necessarily see representation on those levels. And so it sometimes can be a bit daunting or intimidating and can therefore create some barrier in and of itself that way. I think that the more we see even things like signage, things like when there's kind of print and with social media being the way that it is in this day and age, the more representation you see in those spaces as well, the more likely people are going to be feeling more comfortable in outdoor spaces.
As you mentioned, Christopher, people elbowed you and tried to get you to do a more organized effort. In turn, how do you encourage other people to get engaged in this effort and stay engaged?
I think one of the biggest things is to just, you know, and it's easier and sometimes said than done, but just really do it. Get outside, grab some friends or family, figure out what is your comfort zone initially. And one of the things that I think we really need to make a point of saying is outdoor spaces include your front yard. They include going outside the door. And then that is why, indeed, it is called outdoor space. And I think that to that point, having friends or family, peers, colleagues, coworkers, take a walk in the park, take a walk down the street, observe the outdoor space in a way that you might normally not. We're so plugged into electronics and busy schedules these days that we typically don't literally spend time smelling the roses and seeing the forest for the trees. Then there are also just quite a few organizations, not only locally, but regionally and nationally, that are doing their best to continue to try to offer these opportunities up for folks as well. So, you know, we have these wonderful spaces on the internet where you can Google looking for different affinity groups or different organizations. And there are quite a few out there within the social media realm alone that are definitely offering up some fantastic programming and fantastic times outside and in outdoor spaces with groups and with people that are like you.
Now, suppose somebody's listening who runs a local parks department in a community or maybe a state park or whatever level. How would you suggest they kind of inventory and see what they can do if they're thinking, yeah, this sounds great. I want to make sure my park or parks are accessible to everybody.
Well, I think that, you know, one of the biggest things that I encourage folks that are in charge of spaces like that to do is to do an inventory, and not an inventory by themselves, but an inventory with affinity groups, with focus groups, things like that, where you can say, do you feel welcome in these spaces and what could we do differently or better? I think that to that point, anytime a space says, no, we don't need to do that, chances are they really need to do that. So I think that that's one of those kind of self-check situations where it's important to reach out beyond perhaps your circle or bubble and ask folks how they feel and if they indeed do feel comfortable and welcome. And then if the answer is yes, then what could they do to help encourage others and to get the word out?
We're talking to Christopher Kilgore, founder of Color in the Outdoors, also a UW alum. Christopher, are there, I don't know, wins, big or small, that you can point to or even in process right now where you think, yes, we've really moved the needle here?
I think, you know, from a more local, Wisconsin, we'll use that as our parameter space. There are a lot of things that on governmental levels, both within city, county, state government, folks are starting to see that this is indeed an important conversation to be having. There are some efforts being made to that point of showing inclusion when you have brochures and print material. When it comes to the, for instance, the Department of Outdoor Recreation has done a wonderful job of putting together a booklet with representation and intentional representation. There are also other organizations and entities that are starting to do the same. So I think to that point of wins, there are individuals, for instance, a friend of mine, James Mills, who is a guest lecturer at the Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, my alum. I would be remiss if I didn't mention those types of things. But also other organizations. There's an author, Danae O'Dowd, who has written several books with representation of kids of color in the outdoor spaces. There's organizations like Outdoor Afro, Latino Outdoors, et cetera, where we've got, you know, there are more and more organizations and groups doing that and more organizations being brought to the table. And I guess I would say to that point, it's not just having a seat at the table, but it's also having a cup, a plate, a knife, a spoon, and a meal not just having a voice, but being actually included in the conversation in a longer term and in a sustainable way.
At the structural level, I know there were points in American history where cities might be building lots of parks and overwhelmingly building them in predominantly white neighborhoods, not so much in predominantly Black or Latino neighborhoods. How do you start to tackle a bigger problem that's already built in like that?
Well, one of the things that if I were in a perfect world and part of a city planning division, if you will, I would say that not all spaces that are going to be quote unquote renovated, torn down buildings, and that not all should be turned into parking lots and high rises. We definitely need more accessible green space. Those green spaces that are within city limits and city parameters, I think it's also extremely important that there's funding and efforts being made to keep those a place that folks want to be and keep those places being a welcoming space. Even as something as simple as signage and having signs in languages more than just English. There are a lot of folks from a lot of different walks of life. I think we'd also be remiss if we didn't talk about the acknowledgement of having most of the parks, for instance, in the city of Madison, all the parks in the city of Madison being on Ho-Chunk land and having some sort of nod to and an affirmation in talking about those types of things too.
Christopher Kilgore is the founder of the Wisconsin organization Color in the Outdoors. We talked to him earlier this year about how the group is working to bring people from different backgrounds into the outdoors. You can read a WPR article about Color in the Outdoors at our website. It's linked at wpr.org/centraltime. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the U.S. Senate passed a major bill this weekend with a big focus on climate change. We'll find out what that legislation means for clean energy and the effort to slow down global warming. And being a mom can be a lot of work, and that work is often overlooked. That's according to the author of the new book, Essential Labor, Mothering as Social Change. Meet the author and share your own experiences. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the primary elections in Wisconsin are tomorrow. We'll check in on the biggest races on the ballot and the latest on endorsements and some last-minute drama. First, the United States has had more than 350 mass shootings this year, as defined and tracked by the Gun Violence Archive. High-profile mass shootings are leaving some people, including school children, fearful about a shooting in their own hometown or school. Our next guest is a psychologist who says there are ways to help kids and adults deal with that kind of anxiety. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this a problem you've run into, a concern and anxiety you've run into with your kids? Do you wonder how to talk to them when events like mass shootings, especially ones at schools, are in the news? What are you talking about as you head into back-to-school season? Teachers, do you have this concern for yourselves, or do you run into concerns from parents or children at school? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Travis Wright is an associate professor in the Department of Counseling Psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, specializing in early childhood education and teaching students who have experienced trauma. Travis, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, this isn't just about kids, this kind of anxiety, of course, Travis. Can you talk about some of the common emotions people might feel, not even talk about the people who directly experience these events, but those of us who follow them, who see them in the news?
So, we're all stressed. I think that the mass shootings are happening against the broader context of stress. The political system is sort of uncertain. We are in the midst of a global pandemic with potentially another sort of pandemic on the rise. And so I think people generally are stressed. Our baseline is heightened. And so mass shootings are occurring sort of against a backdrop of stress that people are already feeling. And so I think that shootings only heighten the stress that we're already feeling and actually can be something that we can sort of become fixated or focused on because it actually feels a little more concrete than some of the other stressors that we're facing. So I think it can, many of us are probably being impacted by stress in lots of different ways. We may find that we're having trouble sleeping. We may be shorter tempered. We may be having a hard time concentrating and focusing. We may find less meaning in things that used to bring us joy. We may be overeating. We may be undereating. We may have trouble sort of making plans and following through on things. So these are all signs of stress. Some people become hypervigilant, and so they can't stop thinking about it. So you may find that you have children or friends or family members who are just talking about mass shootings all the time. You may have other people who just seem more numb and they're not actually dealing with the stress that they're feeling. They sort of shut down. So stress can look very different. People experience stress very differently. They have different ways of manifesting it, but I think it's safe to assume that everyone is feeling the heat sort of increasing in the pressure cooker right now.
After a horrific event like the Uvalde shooting in Texas, back at the end of the last school year, we're coming into a new school year now. What in particular can parents watch for in their kids who may not, you know, just volunteer or speak up that that particular event is making them feel bad, but it might be there?
Yeah, absolutely. So we should, I think parents should be curious about any types of changes in their children's behavior, particularly trouble sleeping. Younger children may start bedwetting after having not bedwetted for a while, nightmares, kids who are having anxiety about separating from their parents. You may find that your children are having just more distress when they have to be out of your presence. They may not want to leave you to go to school or to go do other things that they used to enjoy. Kids may be engaged in repetitive play when they're really traumatized. They may be playing the same thing over and over. And so if you notice that your kids are playing games about guns, games about violence, games about shooting or being shot over and over again, and it just feels like it isn't very organized or it doesn't feel very low stress, those would be some typical signs that your children might be stressed. But I would say avoidance, lethargy, acting sort of just less interested in daily things are all other kind of signs that you might watch out for as well. Trust your gut. If you're not sure how your child is doing, just ask.
I imagine the answer to this might vary, will vary depending on the age of kids. But when there is a traumatic event in the news and you're pretty sure your kid's going to come across it one way or another, what are some strategies to open up healthier conversations with those kids?
Yes, absolutely. So research shows that kids tend to cope better when they hear about things at home rather than at school or from friends or the media themselves. And so as parents and as guardians, when we know that something has happened that our children are likely to be concerned about or likely to hear about, it's best to bring it up first so that they hear it from us rather than other sources. So the first thing we can do is just to name it and ask children if they've heard about it. The second most important thing that we should do when talking to kids about difficult topics is listen. Ask kids what they know about it. Ask what's on their mind. Ask how they're feeling about it. Listening helps them feel connected. It helps them feel heard. It also gives us a sense of how they're making sense of the event so that we can tailor our responses to sort of how they're processing it. Sometimes kids are worried or worry in a very different way about something than adults because it might affect them differently or they may have a different perspective on the experience. And so when we assume how the children are feeling and we start talking about how things may be for them from our own experience, sometimes we raise questions in their mind that they weren't even thinking about. So we might actually heighten their worry. And other times they just don't feel like we're really paying attention or clued into what's going on with them, that we're making it more about us than about how they're doing. So listening, I would say, is the other most important strategy.
Talking to Travis Wright, associate professor in the Department of Counseling Psychology at UW-Madison, looking at how to help people, kids in particular, cope with news of bad events. Thinking in particular of school shootings as we look ahead to back to school time here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question for our guest, an experience maybe in having this kind of conversation with your kid, if you're a parent, with your classroom, if you're a teacher, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Travis, I think a tough thing to negotiate can be, you know, shootings that we see in the news. These are real and they're scary, but at the same time, even though they're in the news, we see them a lot, in the scope of things, they're pretty rare. Kids are still pretty safe at schools by and large. How do you acknowledge the one thing and that reality of mostly pretty safe places in the other?
Yes. So one thing that we can do is just to make sure that children have that information. So we should share with them that it's actually really rare, that it doesn't happen very often, that most children will never experience anything like this, and explain that the media tends to cover things that are outrageous or things that may be less common. And so even though you're hearing about it a lot, it doesn't mean that it happens a lot. I think the second thing that we can do is actually limit children's exposure to media during times of crisis and really scary things. Children do often hear more than they can process, or when they hear the same thing over and over again, it can heighten their anxiety level and also make it really hard for them to escape it so that they can begin to cope. So I think, you know, letting children know what's happening, making sure that we're having conversations with them to see how they're understanding it, giving them really good information so that we can help them contextualize the likelihood that they're going to experience the event themselves, and also limit their exposure to media, are all things that we can do to help them begin to cope and feel safer.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Linda is with us in Madison. Linda, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have been hearing a lot of hypotheticals and memories and what ifs, but I have a friend in Texas who picked up her 14-year-old niece from school. And of course, given that the child is 14, she has been doing active shooter drills her entire school career. So she's very accustomed to planning for this sort of thing. But as her aunt was driving her home from school, they stopped to get gas at a gas station, and they saw a man by his car carrying a big rifle. And the 14-year-old girl began shaking all over and then crying and vomiting. So I'm thinking of the visceral bodily response in children that may be in the moment, that is a little bit beyond what you're talking about, the fears and the hypotheticals. But this is, what would your guest suggest for a situation that is so very immediate and visceral?
Linda, thanks for the call. Travis, do you have some thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. So in that moment, I think that it's really important to help the child feel grounded, sort of ask them to come into their breath, to sort of, you know, breathing is one of the ways that we can help regulate our body so that we start to feel control over it. What your guest, what Linda was sharing, was this really painful experience of her niece sort of having a traumatic reaction. Sort of in that moment, we were seeing her come undone in a certain way, because this fear that she had been programmed to be afraid of was suddenly potentially coming true, or certainly that fear was being triggered. And so in that moment, we basically feel unsafe. We feel threatened for our lives. And so the most important thing we can do in that moment is to, one, ensure that the person is safe, and to help them realize it. So focusing on the breathing, helping them to sort of feel their body in the car, getting them away from the situation so that they aren't in close proximity to the trigger anymore. But certainly that type of reaction points to the fact that this young woman is really struggling to feel safe. And so I would say that when we see that type of reaction, it's also important to reach out for professional help to make sure that the child has the coping skills that she needs to navigate these really scary things. You know, obviously being closer to the event in proximity. So living in Texas, knowing that these things can happen, already experiencing sort of warnings and being made aware of the danger of these types of threats for her whole life, it sort of was a recipe for this type of reaction. And so I think making sure that she gets the appropriate support to cope is really important. In that moment, I think helping her just feel safe and grounded, and helping her get to safety would be the sort of the acute response. The other thing I would say is, and Linda brought up a really good point about preparing sort of for preparing her entire lifetime for just this type of threat. You know, the research actually suggests that maybe these active shooter drills are causing far more anxiety than they may be benefiting children. And so given that Some of the public health researchers now are actually questioning whether or not children should be doing these types of drills or how often we should be doing these type of drills, because it does actually lay the foundation for just this type of fear.
Linda, thanks for that call. We're talking to Travis Wright, associate professor in the Department of Counseling Psychology at UW-Madison, looking at how to manage fear and anxiety related to mass shootings, especially focusing on kids and back to school time. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Have you had these conversations with your own kids, your own students? Have you seen anxiety in kids you work with or kids in your lives related to these shootings? What questions do you have for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Travis Wright, associate professor in the Department of Counseling Psychology at UW-Madison, with us today to talk about fear and anxiety some people may experience following a mass shooting, what can be done to help deal with that fear, especially when it comes to kids in schools. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a student worried about school shootings? How has news affected you over the years? If you're a parent or teacher, what kind of conversations do you have with kids about these things? Or a school counselor, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Travis, I know a lot of your work involves kids who have trauma, whether a long-term thing in their daily lives or have experienced acute trauma, and how it affects their learning in the classroom. How can teachers help kids in those situations learn?
Yeah, absolutely. So trauma makes it very hard to learn. When we're worried for our lives, when we're scanning the environment, wondering what's going to go wrong next, it's very difficult to focus on things like math and reading and remembering sort of historical facts. So in order for kids who've experienced trauma to actively engage the curriculum and to learn, it's really important for them to feel safe and also respected. And so some things that teachers can do are making sure that there are consistent routines, making sure that there are schedules, that kids know what's going to happen, that there are clear procedures and processes in the classroom. And increasingly in my own work, I'm learning that trauma not only affects the way kids feel at school, but it actively impacts the way that they process information and learn as well. So, for example, kids that are developing in the midst of challenging circumstances where scary things seem to happen out of nowhere often don't develop a sense of cause and effect. So they sort of walk through the world and things just happen. So as they're processing information, they don't necessarily connect that information to each other in a logical way. And so as teachers, it's really important to sort of point out the connections between narratives. This happened and that happened and this happened, to really point out cause and effect relationships so that kids begin to make connections between sort of what happened before and what's happening next and then what's going to happen as a consequence. That not only helps children learn better, but it also helps reinforce the idea that there is actually some logic and some reason and some predictability in the world. And I think that both helps kids learn better, but it also helps them begin to feel more regulated and safe and stable as well. When we've experienced scary things, it changes the way that we view the world. And so anything that we can do to help things feel like they make more sense helps individuals and especially children begin to heal from traumatic experiences.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Rich is with us in Burlington. Rich, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and I really appreciate your guest bringing up the fact that the active shooter drills and all that could be creating more stress. I'm a retired school teacher. I taught high school science. One of the things I taught was chemistry, and anytime we did explosions, which is really the whole point of teaching chemistry, but anytime we did explosions, we had to let everyone know that this was coming, this is going to happen. We didn't level a building or anything, but just some of the typical stuff that's done in chemistry classroom because it was stressful. I taught through the years when Columbine occurred, and it was years before we had anywhere near full attendance in our school on the anniversary date of Columbine. And I really ascribe that to much of the overhype of school shootings. And I'm not saying school shootings don't happen and they're not tragic. I absolutely believe that. But if you were to look at the total negative effect on all of the kids in the country and the stress and the suicide rate among young people is way up. The stress of the training and the active shooter drills where we had kids huddled in the corner and we're throwing desks against the doors. And you know, we had SWAT teams walking down the halls just to simulate. And that stress, I am sure total effect had to be far in excess. And I'm not downplaying a real school shooting.
I gotcha, Rich. Thanks for the call. And Travis, that gets back to something you were talking about earlier, some pushback on the idea that these active shooter drills are a net plus.
That's it. You know, I really appreciate Rich's perspective as an insider to the school experience. And I think one of the things that we have to keep in mind when we're deciding how to address issues in particular communities is that maybe a one-size-fits-all approach doesn't work. The reality is that there are different levels of risk in different communities. The type of support and the type of intervention and the level of risk in one place may be very different than the risk in another place. You know, in communities with high rates of violence, it's important for children to know how to keep themselves safe and what the procedures are. And if they don't know that information, it feels more scary. But in contrast, in communities where the risk may be pretty low or children haven't experienced or been exposed to violence, discussions of violence can actually heighten their anxiety. And so I think when we make decisions about what's best for children, we have to remember that schools are local, that they happen in neighborhoods, that they happen in communities. And so we should be talking with kids and teachers in those communities about what they need. Far too often, we sort of politicize the school environment and we sort of make policies based on what would make us feel better or what we think should happen. But many times this isn't aligned with what kids and teachers in that particular school need. So I think really being in touch with how kids are feeling, how teachers are feeling, how families are feeling, and tailoring the sort of supports that we provide is critical.
Thanks for that call, yeah. Rich. Time for one more caller. Kathy's with us in Madison. Kathy, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm concerned that we are talking about this like it is accepted. And this is just the way it is. It's like, okay, we have one more degree of Celsius heat. So that's the way that is. We're not doing much about that either. But why aren't we talking about changing?
Kathy, we're just about out of time, but Travis, I know that's important to you. People can kind of take control in some ways by becoming active on issues. In our last few moments, can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that is most traumatizing to us is feeling powerless and out of control. And so I agree with your caller that when we accept violence as a part of life and we send our children to school worrying that they're not going to be safe, that's just a recipe for feeling fearful and anxious and out of control. So one of the things that we can do as parents, as community members, as grandparents, and as students is we can speak up about the policies that we would like to change to make our school safer. You know, meaningful gun control, for example, if that's something that your family believes would help. I think being involved at the social level and helping feel like you're having an impact on what's happening around you helps you feel more agency, which ultimately helps you feel safer in the end.
Kathy, thanks for that call. And Travis, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Travis Wright, associate professor in the Department of Counseling Psychology at UW-Madison. He specializes in early childhood education and teaching students who've experienced various forms of trauma. Coming up after the news, we'll get a preview of the top races on the ballot tomorrow in Wisconsin's primary election. In-person voting is tomorrow. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.